So I want to start with the question, why should I care what you think? And actually, there are some good answers. One reason for me to care what you think is that, well, for example, if you've already decided that this is not a very good talk, then you might go and tell your friends that I'm a bad philosopher, and they might not want to talk to me or invite me to conferences, and that would be bad. So I hope you don't think that already. If you've now decided that I'm actually a pretty awful person, then you might decide to stay away from me and you might tell all your friends to avoid me. If for some reason you think that I stole your wallet, you might go and tell the police that I stole your wallet. In fact, I didn't, but if you tell the police that, then that will be bad for me. So those are all some reasons for me to care about what you think. Now, all of those are reasons that are kind of concerned with the effects of your beliefs. So I care about what you think because what you think affects what you do. And if the effects of your belief don't flow in the way that I just suggested they do, then I don't really care. So for example, if you've decided that this is a bad paper, but you're very polite and you would never mention that to me and you would never tell anyone, then that won't have the same effect on whether other people will talk to me anymore. Conversely, if you know that I didn't steal your wallet, but you decide that you'll tell the police that I stole your wallet anyway, then that will have the same bad effect as if your belief was really there. So anyway, one reason for me to care about your beliefs is that they affect your actions and your actions can harm me and benefit me. But that's not the whole story. I also care about your beliefs intrinsically or for their own sakes, regardless of what their effects are. So for example, I care about my reputation. And if you think that I'm a really bad philosopher or a really horrible person, then even if you never tell anyone and even if you're really nice to me, that means I don't have the good reputation that I want to have. The quality of my relationships depends on what you believe. So for example, I'd like to think that the reason I was invited here is that Jörg thought that I might give an interesting talk. But if it turns out that the reason he invited me is that he made a mistake, he meant to send the email to somebody else called Simon, and it accidentally went to me, and now he's too polite to withdraw the invitation, and he's terrified of the horrible talk that I'm going to give and how bad it's going to make me look and how bad it's going to make him look, if that's what he's thinking, then we don't have the valuable relationship that I'd like to have with him, the kind of respectful relationship I'd like to have. Furthermore, I've put some time and effort into preparing this talk. And part of the point of me putting time and effort into preparing this talk is to try to make you change your mind, maybe think differently about belief and friendship by the time that I've finished. Or if I can't make you change your mind, I'd at least like you to think that there are some decent arguments for my view. And if by the end of this talk, you all walk out thinking, well, that was horrible, that was a total waste of time, there was nothing worth thinking about in that talk, well, then all that time that I've spent has been wasted. It turns out that I failed in one of my main projects. And that's true even if I never find out that you thought the talk was awful. My goal in preparing the talk is to change your minds, not just to make it seem to me as though you've changed your minds. So, as it turns out, I'm actually interested in your beliefs and what you think, not just because they affect what you do, but intrinsically as well. Now, you might think that that's a kind of pathology, that there's a problem with me, that I seem so interested in what's going on inside your minds. And one way to ask whether it makes sense for me to care about your beliefs is to think about whether your beliefs can have any direct impact on my well-being or on how well my life goes, on my welfare. Now, one theory of well-being is the mental state theory, or hedonism, which says that how well things go for you is just a matter of whether you have good or bad experiences, subjective experiences. Now, if you're a mental state theorist or a hedonist, then you'll think that it's completely mistaken of me to care about what you think, or at least to care for my own sake about what you think, because so long as your thoughts don't affect my conscious experience, they make no difference to my well-being. But while that's a well-known, established theory, most people don't believe it. And the reason why most people don't believe the mental state theory or hedonism is that it has some very strange implications. Most famously, it implies that if I was connected to an experience machine, just a whole lot of wires in my head, and even though I was helpless and completely deceived and completely out of touch with reality, I had these fantastic experiences all the time induced by the wires that are poking into my brain. Actually, I'm just sitting here like a vegetable, but as far as I'm concerned, from my subjective point of view, I'm, I don't know, winning Wimbledon and acting in wonderful movies and writing brilliant novels. Now, from a hedonist point of view, I'm living the best life possible. I'm having these wonderful experiences. But most of us think that there's something that I'm missing. The fact that my life is based on a lie, that I have no connection with reality, seems to count against me. And I guess that's kind of the same point that I'm making when I say that I care about what you actually think about me, not just about how your thoughts affect my state of mind. But anyway, but if you're a mental state theorist or a hedonist, that's fine. You probably don't need to listen to the rest of the talk. Other theories of well-being have different implications for the effects of your beliefs on my interests. So the desire theory says that me having a high level of well-being is a matter of me getting what I want, or perhaps what I would want if I was fully informed, something like that. And from that, it follows straightforwardly that your beliefs can influence my well-being, because if what I want is for you to have certain beliefs, then whether my desires are fulfilled depends on whether you have those beliefs. So it affects my well-being. And the third major theory of well-being, the objective list theory, which says that there are certain substantive goods like perhaps freedom, knowledge, wisdom, pleasure, friendship, I don't know, achievement, that these are the sorts of kind of substantive goods that constitute well-being. On most versions of the objective list theory as well, it'll turn out that your beliefs can have a direct influence, an intrinsic influence on my well-being, because usually the goods that are listed on the objective list turn out to be things that take in such matters as the quality of my relationships, whether my life is based on a lie, whether I really achieve the things that I set out to achieve, not just whether it seems to me that I achieve them. So at least for two of the three main theories of well-being, it seems like it makes a lot of sense for me to care intrinsically about what you think of me and what you're thinking right now and how well my paper's going. Now, I think there's a good independent argument for thinking that in one way or another, what you think of me has a bearing on my quality of life. And just very briefly, it's something like this. I've spent part of my life, not a big part, but a part of my life, preparing this paper. And I've put quite a bit of effort into trying to make it persuasive. Now, whether that part of my life is successful depends on whether I persuade anybody, whether I achieve the goals that I set out to achieve, that I arrange part of my life around, surely bears upon whether that part of my life succeeds. But if it bears on whether that part of my life succeeds, then surely it bears on how well my life goes from my point of view. And maybe you think that's a matter of my well-being, maybe you think it's a matter of something else, like my flourishing or my success or something different. But in one way or another, it seems it makes a difference to me. So that's a reason, I think, for thinking that the mental state theory is not correct, and a reason for thinking that one way or another, the quality of my life depends on whether my projects succeed, whether I have good, high-quality relationships based on mutual understanding rather than lies, and so on. If you're convinced by what I've said so far, then you ought to be feeling quite a lot of power at the moment, right? Because as you sit there listening to my talk, the quality of my life is in your hands or in your minds. What beliefs you form about my talk is going to make a difference to whether this bit of my life goes well. And if that's true, you know, of me, imagine how much more true or how much you know, how much more that applies to your relationships, not with, you know, anonymous philosophy speakers, but with your friends and loved ones. You probably have friends and siblings and parents and, I don't know, romantic partners and teachers and cousins who care a lot about their relationships with you. And what you think of them can make a difference to the quality of those relationships. So, for example, if you are always saying nasty things or thinking nasty things about your friend, if you really think that they're not a very good person, then they don't have the kind of friendship with you that they think they have. So you have a lot of power over their lives as well. And that means that there's a way in which we can assess your beliefs. We can ask, do you have the beliefs that are of most benefit to other people, to your friends, to your loved ones, and to me? We can also ask another question about your beliefs. We can ask, are your beliefs true? Or are your beliefs based on the evidence? And at least offhand, it seems like our answers to those different questions might be different. We might say, for example, yes, you have the beliefs that most benefit your friend, but no, you don't have the beliefs that follow from the evidence. For example, you might be thinking right now, you know, it'd be nice, given that he's pleaded with me so many times, for me to believe that this is a good talk. But unfortunately, the evidence before me shows that it's not. So you're kind of torn. Do I believe what's in the interests of Simon, or do I believe the truth? So that's an interesting result, that perhaps there's a conflict between two kinds of reasons to believe, reasons based on the evidence and reasons based on other people's interests. But there are lots of reasons to think that that conflict, even if it exists, is not nearly as interesting as I've tried to suggest that it is. And here are some of them. Firstly, the mere fact that you have power that you can wield through your beliefs doesn't mean that you have any responsibility. And that's because it's not clear that you have any choice over what you believe. You can't believe at will. If I ask you right now to believe that Wellington is the capital of Switzerland, I bet you can't do it. Right? Maybe you could take a pill or bang yourself on the head or go and see a hypnotist, but you couldn't do it. You couldn't just do it at will. Similarly, if I say, you know, it's really, 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 really important that you believe that my paper is decent or something, you might agree and you might think, yeah, it'd be nice for me to believe that, but I just can't do it because, you know, the evidence doesn't support it. So that's a good point. We can't believe at will. So I can't form beliefs for your sake in the same way in which I can perform certain actions for your sake just by deciding to do it. But that said, we do have some indirect control over our beliefs, and we can exercise that control within limits. So, for example, if you decided that it'd be really interesting or really good to become a skeptic about climate change, you can't just do it, but you can carry out strategies that will make it more likely that you'll become a skeptic about climate change. For example, you could spend a whole lot of time on certain parts of the internet, and you could decide only ever to read things written by people who are climate change skeptics, and you could decide never to read anything by anybody who believes in climate change. And that's playing a trick on yourself, but you can play tricks on yourself, and sometimes it works. So you could predict that by trying to only have contact with climate change skepticism, eventually some of that skepticism will seep through into your beliefs. Similarly, in listening to my talk, you might decide to listen in a very charitable mood. You might decide to force yourself to giggle at some of the jokes. Or if you notice that I'm saying something that's very implausible, you might just decide to close your eyes and not listen for a while. Afterwards, when you're talking with each other about the talk, you could start the conversation in different ways. So, for example, when you start the conversation, you could say something like, well, I thought that was pretty good. There were some nice thoughts in there. Or if you wanted to form negative beliefs about the talk, you could start the conversation by saying, God, that was terrible. Don't you agree? And by directing the conversation in certain ways, you can predict that your attention will be drawn to different things and you'll receive different kinds of feedback just from the way conversational dynamics work, and you'll end up with a different, you know, maybe, anyway, there's a good chance you'll end up with a different set of beliefs about the talk. So at least within some limits, you do have power to influence your own beliefs. And when you do so, you can do it, if you like, with the goal of having the beliefs that will benefit somebody else, even if those beliefs aren't what follow straight from the evidence. Even admitting that, though, you might think, well, if I engage in that kind of strategy, it's going to be self-defeating. What I mean by that is that if the reason why you have certain beliefs is that you've tricked yourself into having them, then at that point, maybe they won't be of any benefit to anyone after all. So, for example, when I say that I care about my reputation, what I mean is not really that I just hope people think well of me. Rather, I mean that I hope people think well of me because they have good evidence for thinking well of me. So if it turns out that everybody thinks well of me, but only because they've taken a drug or been to see a hypnotist, then I don't have the good reputation that I want to have for the reasons that I want to have it. Similarly, you know, if it turns out that, people think this was a good talk, but only because I slipped something into their coffee beforehand, then I don't have the achievement that I hoped to accrue in putting effort into writing the talk. But even that consideration doesn't cover all cases. There are some cases in which you can control what you believe and do so in a way that successfully brings a benefit to somebody else. So consider a couple of examples. First, it might be that the evidence before you, based on my paper, gives you a perfectly good reason to think that the paper was absolutely awful. Maybe that's what you'd think about the normal philosophy paper given by someone. But if you're feeling especially sympathetic towards me, then you might be able to get yourself to think, well, it wasn't completely awful. If you listen in a sympathetic enough mood and you concentrate on the right parts of the paper, you might be able to come out thinking, it was pretty bad, but there were some nice ideas there. There are things worth developing. And if you can do that, then, you know, I've been a little bit more successful in affecting your minds than I would have been if you'd just gone out thinking that was straight out awful. Or consider another example. I said that whether I have a respectful relationship with Jörg, who invited me, depends partly on whether he did it because he thought I'd give a good talk or whether he instead did it because he thought, I don't know, it would be a good practical joke, or because, you know, he mistakenly invited me when he meant to invite somebody else. Now, even if... So I'd like to think that he invited me because he thought I might give a good talk. Now, so long as that's the case, even if his beliefs about the likely quality of my talk aren't based on the evidence, nevertheless, so long as that's what he believes, then we have our respectful relationship. We have a relationship that's not based on a lie, from my point of view. So in some cases, even if somebody's beliefs are formed in a way that is self-manipulative or that is intended to lead probably to certain beliefs, even if the evidence doesn't fully support those beliefs, sometimes those kinds of beliefs can still give the kinds of reputational and relationship and other sorts of benefits that beliefs can give people. So, what have we got? I've tried to show you that your beliefs can make a difference to my well-being. Furthermore, that within certain limits, you are able to form belief-forming strategies that make it more likely that you'll have certain beliefs where those beliefs will be to my benefit, and that you're following those strategies can mean you're conducting yourself in a way that's different from the way you conduct yourself if you just wanted to have true beliefs or beliefs that are based on the evidence. But even if you're able to do that, you might wonder whether you ever should. I mean, why should you form beliefs for my sake? After all, there's lots of things you could do that would benefit me. for example, you could take out your checkbook and write me, people don't have checkbooks anymore, but you could take out your phone and transfer some money to my account right now. And I'd be happy to give you the details if you'd like to do that. That's something you could do that would benefit me, but of course you've got no reason to, or no good reason. You know, you shouldn't do it. It would be kind of creepy if you did. And in the same way, you might think, yeah, maybe I could form beliefs that would benefit you, but why should I? Why should I put your interests ahead of my epistemic integrity? And that's a good question. And what I want to do for the rest of the talk is to say that, yeah, well, you don't have a good reason, probably, to form beliefs for the sake of strangers. You can have a good reason to form beliefs for someone else's sake in some very particular kinds of relationships, and in particular, in certain sorts of friendships. So that's where the rest of the paper is headed. Why would I think that it makes a difference whether someone's your friend? Well, suppose that you are, in fact, my friend, not just a stranger listening to a stranger give a talk. How could that make a difference to the way in which you might listen to my talk? Well, first of all, the fact that it would benefit me if you had certain beliefs, arguably, has more significance if I'm your friend than if I'm not. Because after all, we often think that we have good reasons to provide certain benefits for our friends, but virtually no reason at all to provide those benefits for a stranger. So, for example, if somebody is visiting town, if it's my friend, I might have a really good reason, maybe even an obligation, to offer that they come stay at my house. But if a stranger visits town, I've got virtually no reason to offer that they stay at my house. So the fact that it's a friend involved can mean that giving the same benefit comes with a really strong reason rather than virtually no reason at all. At least some philosophers have argued that when you have reasons of friendship, they can actually be so strong as to compete with and maybe even outweigh other really strong conflicting reasons. So, for example, there are two philosophers, Dean Cocking and Jeanette Kennett, who have argued that sometimes you have good reason to act immorally for the sake of a friend. The example that they use calls on an old saying, which is, A friend is someone who helps you move house. A good friend is someone who helps you move a body. So the idea is that sometimes you'll do something immoral, or at least you'll accept that you have reason to do something that's immoral, if that's what it takes in order to serve your friend's interests. So I'm not sure whether that's true, but at least it's some precedent for thinking of reasons of friendship as powerful enough and of being of such content that they can conflict with and even overwhelm reasons of a different sort, moral reasons, or in my case, epistemic reasons. In addition, some of the most important goods of friendship, the distinctive goods, you know, the things that make friends worth having, the things that friends can do for each other that allow them to make each other's lives better, have to do with what we believe. One thing that I look for in my friends is support. So when things are going badly in the rest of my life, it's good to know that my friends support me. Now, sometimes their support just involves they're being nice to me, you know, letting me talk to them, letting me stay at their house, buying me drinks, whatever else. But sometimes it also involves feeling as though they're on my side when everybody else isn't. So, for example, if you've been accused of doing something really terrible, you can appreciate having a friend who supports you through your ordeal, where that doesn't just mean that they're nice to you even though they think you're probably guilty. It actually means them believing you and sticking by you when you tell them that you're innocent. And maybe a really good friend will stick by you even when the evidence suggests that they shouldn't. So that's one thing you can look for in a good friend, someone who really believes in you and sticks by you. Also, the kind of support that you look for in a good friend can be a good of kind of sincere encouragement. So one thing that's nice about having friends is that when you're pretty sure that things are going badly, and that you're not going to get the job, or that your thesis is not going to get passed, or that you've made an embarrassment of yourself in front of everybody, it's nice to have a friend who you can call up and he'll reassure you. He'll say, look, things aren't that bad. You'll get there. You've got a good chance of getting the job. Of course your thesis will get passed. It wasn't so embarrassing. And if your friend can do that in a sincere way, then they're offering the support that you actually want. You actually want somebody who believes in you, not someone who can just fake it. Another kind of good that friends can give you is a good of what we might call openness or vulnerability. Friendships often involve letting down our guard. So if you're my friend, then I might, for example, go and watch a football game with you, even though I know that football is silly. But if that's something that you're interested in, then I'll go, I'll do it with you, and I'll try to enjoy it, I'll do my best. Whereas if it was a stranger inviting me, of course, I would never go. Or if there's some new band that you want to go see and you recommend them to me, then I might go along, not necessarily because I think you've got good taste in music, but just because I think, well, you're my friend and I'll give you the benefit of the doubt. I'll come along and I'll do my best to enjoy it because that's one of the things that friends do. But again, that calls upon my beliefs indirectly, because in order to be open and vulnerable to your point of view, I have to allow myself to see the world through your eyes. And that can mean taking the world to be a certain way, not because I have evidence that it's that way, but rather because that's what it takes for me to give you the kind of friendship that I want to give you. And certainly, speaking for myself, I like giving talks and knowing that there's a friend in the audience, or knowing that my mother's in the audience. Even that can be nice. Because then you know that even when you feel like it's going badly, you've forgotten what you were going to say, your jokes aren't working, whatever else, it's just nice to have someone in the audience and to be able to look at them and know that they're thinking the best of you. That they're, they nod encouragingly and they mean it. They're not just being insincere. And again, I don't think that way about my friend or my mother necessarily because I think that she's going to be a good judge of whether this is a good philosophy talk. I may know that at the end of the day, whether I've given a good talk or not isn't up to my mother to decide. But just knowing that she's there and that she thinks well of me and cares for me and always thinks that I'm doing well allows me to be kind of encouraged and to see myself in a better light and to feel a bit more positive about things. So those are reasons to think that when it comes to friendship in particular, it's not just that we're able to form beliefs for the sake of other people, but we actually have reason to do so as part of the normal activity of being a good friend, at least sometimes within certain limits in some friendships. I've made a lot of confessions about things that I'm not very proud of. So I'm not proud of the fact that I rely on sympathetic, biased beliefs of my mother and my friends in order to make me feel better about myself. And if I was a better person and if I was a better philosopher or a more virtuous philosopher, then I wouldn't need that kind of support. I wouldn't need to hope that there are people out there who are feeling sympathetic and listening in a charitable way. If I was a more virtuous person, then all I'd care about was the truth. And I'd just hope that there were people out there who were going to help me to get closer to the truth. And if my paper's really terrible, then I want to know that because it's the truth. There's a way of thinking about friendship on which truly good friends would never have any reason to be biased towards each other and their beliefs. Why? Because truly good friends would be thoroughly virtuous. And in particular, on Platonic and possibly Aristotelian pictures of friendship, two really good friends would be thoroughly virtuous people who spend most of their time thinking about philosophy. And if you're in that kind of friendship, then of course, you'll have no need for support and encouragement and being propped up and being open to each other's view, because all that you'll want is evidence and argument and truth. And on one way, a distinctively Aristotelian way of looking at friendship, that's enough to show that what I'm suggesting about the way that friends behave cannot be an element of a good friendship, right? If a good friendship is a friendship between virtuous people, and the reason why We want our friends to think well of us, even perhaps in spite of the evidence, is that we're not virtuous. We suffer from certain flaws. We suffer from self-doubt and from tiredness and from ennui and so on. If that's the reason why we require those things from our friends, well, then that's just evidence that we're not in good friendships. And furthermore, if the point of a friendship is to encourage and involve the practice of virtue, then, of course, a good friendship shouldn't involve any kind of epistemic bias. Why? Because if it does involve epistemic bias, if it involves believing things in spite of the evidence, then there's a sense in which it involves a vice, right? The vice of failing to follow the evidence where it leads, a lack of epistemic virtue. And that's enough to show it's not a good friendship, because friendship is all about virtue and the encouragement and admiration of virtue between two friends. In order for me to make my suggestion plausible, then, in order for me to make it plausible to think that sometimes within a perfectly good friendship you can have reason to form beliefs for the sake of somebody else, I need to set aside that Aristotelian picture of friendship. And that's what I'm going to try to do now. And it seems to me that there are two big Aristotelian assumptions about friendship, which are very widely held, but in my opinion, wrong-headed. The first assumption is that there is a single, reasonably determinate picture of good friendship. That is to say, in other words, that good friendship has a certain single function, and therefore that all good friendships, even if they differ in many ways, are basically the same. So all good friendships are about recognizing and cultivating virtue, for example. Or all good friendships are about seeing yourself in the other and understanding yourself better as a result. So that's the first assumption. And the reason I think that that is wrong, at least as applied to humans, people like us, is that it just doesn't have much to do with the kinds of reasons why we want to have friends and the kinds of friendships that we, in fact, have. As a matter of fact, we have very different relationships with different friends, and we get different good things from our relationships with different friends. You might have a friend with whom you go hiking, who knows certain things about you, and another friend who's a colleague who knows utterly different things about you. You might have one friend who you long to talk to about your relationship problems, but would never talk to about your work. And another friend who you love seeing partly because all you ever do is talk about sport, and that's one of the attractions of the relationship, and not knowing anything about her family or her hopes and dreams is kind of partly what makes the relationship fun. Some friends are really fun to be with but completely exhausting. Other friends are kind of therapeutic but kind of boring. And all these different friends give you different things. And I don't think we should assume that because they're different in those ways, because they're different, give you different sorts of goods, some of them must be better than others, or they're all failing in certain respects. So that means, I think, that it's quite coherent to say there are some friends who we rely on for sort of epistemic support, some friends who sometimes we hope will have beliefs for our sakes. But that's not true of all of our friends, and it's not true of any of our friends all the time. It's just one good thing that friends can do for us. And it doesn't imply that whenever you have good friends, you'll have epistemic bias. Just suggest that sometimes this is one good thing that a friend can give you. The second Aristotelian assumption is that good friendship must be such as to fit very neatly into the good life more broadly. So it's very important, I think, to Aristotle and certainly to lots of his, contemporary followers, that being a good friend is a way of being a virtuous person. So that if you are a good friend, then to that extent you are also wise and courageous and compassionate and so on. And again, I think that's a nice, attractive picture of friendship. The idea of two thoroughly virtuous friends who become even more virtuous through their admiration of each other is very attractive. But it doesn't tell me anything much about my friendships. And there's another way of thinking about goodness in friendship, which is to think of friendship's function as serving the interests of people who are not perfect, making life a little bit better, a little bit less intense, a little bit less lonely for people who are not fully virtuous and are never going to be fully virtuous. And if we can accept that friendship can play that function and that a friendship can be good because it performs that function well in one way or another, then we should stop expecting that being a good friend is compatible always with being a virtuous person in every other respect. It may turn out that in order to give me what I most need, given that I'm imperfect and I have different needs from a virtuous person, you have to do something that's not thoroughly virtuous, like believing something in spite of the evidence. Why should that not be the case? If that's what I need, then that's what you as a friend might choose to give me. There's a paper by a philosopher called Jason Carwell in which he attacks the view that friendship could involve epistemic bias. And at one point he says that the idea that you would want your friends to be biased towards you, to have beliefs for your sake and not just based on the evidence, is childish. He says that's how children think. And in particular he says it's juvenile. And I agree, but I think that juveniles and children can have friends. And I also think that there's kind of a juvenile or a child in all of us, that as a matter of fact, we have needs and desires and hopes that the fully virtuous person would not have. And part of the point of friendship is to respond to those needs and hopes and desires. And yeah, that involves treating each other a little bit as children sometimes. But that's what we do with our friends, isn't it? You know, when your friend's broken up with his wife, or when she's been turned down for a really important job, you know, you kind of soothe her and comfort her and give her what she needs in the same way that you do to a child who's upset or to a child who's had a bad day. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's part of treating each other not as fully virtuous people, but as real, genuine humans. So if I can draw an analogy that might be helpful, I think that good friendship can be a bit like good palliative care. So palliative care is, I mean, a fully healthy person has no need for palliative care. And furthermore, the point of palliative care is not to restore somebody to full health. Rather, palliative care is about making life a little bit less horrible, a little bit more bearable, maybe even fun, maybe even happy, maybe even rewarding, for somebody who is never going to be fully healthy again. In the same way, you know, given that most of us are not fully virtuous and that that's just something we have to live with, one of the things that helps make life a bit better is having a good friend who supports you and who responds to you as you actually are, not in some effort to make you more like Aristotle. I want to finish by considering a couple of possible objections to the view that I've put forward. And in particular, these are objections that can kind of acknowledge that we might have different ways of forming beliefs about our friends without conceding that sometimes in order to be good friends, we have to be epistemically irresponsible. First of all, you might think that, yeah, we're biased towards our friends, but that doesn't mean that we are more likely to believe false things about our friends or that we're less likely to believe based on the evidence. Why not? Well, firstly, it may be that the mere fact that someone is my friend is itself a piece of evidence for thinking well of them. Maybe I know them very well, so I have a background of positive belief about them that I don't have for a stranger. Maybe the fact that they are my friend shows that we share a mutual trust, and therefore the fact that we have a mutual trust means that I have evidence to think that my friend is trustworthy, which can mean that I have good evidence that whatever she tells me or whatever she thinks is more likely to be correct, something like that. Or you might even think that actually when we approach our friends, we have an attitude of charity and sympathy, which ideally we'd have towards everybody. It's just that we don't have enough energy to have it towards everybody. So perhaps you might think, yes, as your friend, I will listen to your paper in a more sympathetic mood. But that's not to say, and I'll predictably come up with different beliefs about your paper from the ones that I'd come up with if it was a stranger giving the paper. But that doesn't mean that my beliefs, in the case of my friend, will be worse. It just means that they'll be different, and in a way they'll be better. Because a sympathetic, charitable hearing is what we'd ideally give everybody, if only we, you know, could bring ourselves to do it. So that's one response. Another way of making this claim, that is that yes, we think differently about our friends, but that doesn't mean that our beliefs are irresponsible, epistemically speaking, is to accept the doctrine of what's called epistemic permissiveness. And that's the view that, at least often, when you have a single set of evidence, there's a range of permissible beliefs that you can form based on the evidence. So you might say, yeah, when I listen to a talk, if it's given by a stranger, then I'm most likely to have these beliefs about it. Whereas when it's given by a friend, I'm most likely to have these different beliefs about it. But that doesn't mean that I'm doing anything epistemically irresponsible in either case, because maybe I'm permitted epistemically to have either set of beliefs. Maybe the evidence, you know, allows me some leeway. Anyway, that's another response. And I just have a couple of things to say about those strategies. The first thing to say is that they accept that sometimes we change our beliefs not based on the evidence, but based on our concern for somebody else's interests. So even if we do that in a way that brings us closer to the truth than we would in the case of than we'd get in the case of a stranger, or even if we do it in a way that keeps us within the bounds of epistemical responsibility, still, we're changing our beliefs, we're changing our ways of listening to papers and reading poetry and thinking about our friends' relationships and so on. We're doing it in ways that make us more likely to have certain beliefs. Why? Because those are the beliefs that will most benefit our friend. So even on these strategies, there's still a place for believing, not just based on the evidence, but for the sake of somebody else. But more importantly, I just can't see any reason to expect that these kinds of strategies will manage to cover all of the cases. It just seems to me like it's two completely separate questions. Firstly, what beliefs could I have that would benefit my friend, given that she's an imperfect person with strange needs and strange desires and with, you know, all kinds of human failings and foibles? That's one question. And the other question, which beliefs should I have based on the evidence? I just don't see why the answers to the two questions should be the same, or why it should always be the case that we can make them cohere in one way or another. So I think that at least sometimes we face a kind of dilemma. In order to be good friends, we have to sacrifice our epistemic integrity. In order to maintain our epistemic integrity, we have to fail to give our friends what they most need. And I think that's just a problem that as real humans we have to face. I said at the start that I wanted to change your minds about the nature of friendship and the kinds of pressures that apply to our beliefs. And that's still true. But I also kind of hope that maybe by now what I've said doesn't seem so radical or so surprising after all. At the very least, it seems to me that there are lots of everyday practices and understandings that, when we think about it, incorporate the idea that often part of being a good friend or a good parent or a good sibling or a good romantic partner involves being biased in your beliefs. So, for example, if I go into court to give evidence in favour of or against my friend, I have to declare that they're my friend. If I'm sitting on a committee that's choosing somebody for a job and one of the candidates is my friend, I have to tell everybody that they're my friend. And that's not necessarily because other people in the court or on the panel should think that I'll tell lies. Rather, it's because even if I speak sincerely, my beliefs are likely to be biased. I'm likely to think that my friend is a better job candidate than she really is. I'm likely to think that my friend didn't carry out the crime when maybe she really did. So the fact that I have that bias is something I have to declare. Again, I don't know enough German to know if it's the same here, but certainly in English we have sayings like never go into business with a friend or never bet on a friend. It's just a bad policy. Why? Well, partly because if you go into business with a friend, you might end up fighting with them and the friendship will end. But that's not the whole story. It's also because when you go into business or when you place a bet, you ought to think clearly and prudently about whether the investment is worth making. And it's just really hard to do that when your friends are involved. It's very hard to be hard-headed and objective and impartial when you're dealing with a friend. And certainly, you know, I think that we also manage our own beliefs in ways that reflect the fact that part of being a good friend involves sometimes having epistemic bias. So, for example, if you gave me some of your poetry to read, and I read it, and I came back and I said, yeah, I think it's good, excellent. And you said, oh, fantastic, because I want to publish it and I need $10,000. At that point, I'd think, hang on, I wasn't exactly lying when I said that the poetry was good. I was being sincere, but I'm not going to put $10,000 towards a friend's poetry project or a friend's music project or a friend's business. Why? Not because I don't believe in them, but just because I know it's bad policy. At a certain point, you have to let your more rational self put a brake on what your friendly self is encouraging you to believe. That's all I've got.